Letty, almost whispering, said, "Very sorry about that, Mr. Brigance." "No problem. Look, Ms. Lang, there is a very important matter we need to discuss as soon as possible, preferably tomorrow in my office. It's about Mr. Hubbard and his last will and testament." Letty bit her bottom lip as she stared wild-eyed at Jake. "Tell me more." Jake continued, "The day before he died, he made a new will, one that he dropped in the mail so I would receive it after his death. It appears to be a valid will, but I'm sure it will be contested by his family."
"Am I in his will?"
"You certainly are. In fact, he left a sizable portion of his estate to you."
"Oh, God!"
"Yes. He wants me to be the lawyer for his estate, and I'm sure that will be contested, too. That's why we need to talk." Her right hand covered her mouth as she mumbled,
"Oh, my Lord!"
Jake looked at the house, where the light from its windows cut through the darkness. A shadow moved beyond it, probably Simeon circling around. Jake had the sudden desire to hop into the old Saab and cut a trail quickly back to civilization. She asked, nodding,
"Should I tell him?"
"That's up to you. I would have included him, but I've heard stories about his drinking. Didn't know what shape he's in right now. But to be honest, Miss Lang, he's your husband, and he should come with you tomorrow. That is, if he's in good shape."
"He'll be in good shape, I promise."
Jake handed her a business card and said, "Anytime tomorrow afternoon. I'll be in my office waiting."
"We'll be there, Mr. Brigance. And thank you for coming here."
"It's very important, Ms. Lang, and I felt like I needed to meet you. We could be in for a long, hard fight together."
"I'm not sure I understand."
"I know. I'll explain it tomorrow."
"Thank you, Mr. Brigance."
"Good night."
Chapter 7. After a quick late supper of grilled cheese and tomato soup, Jake and Carla cleared the table and cleaned the dishes. There was no dishwasher. And eventually settled in the den, which began where the kitchen left off, some 6 feet away from the dining table. 3 years plus in tight living quarters required a constant reassessment of priorities and attitudes, along with a vigilance against edginess. Hannah helped tremendously. Small children care little for the material things that so impress adults. As long as both parents are doting, little else matters. Carla helped her with spelling, and Jake read her stories, and as they tag-teamed through the evening, they also caught up with the daily papers and the cable news. At 8 p.m. on the dot, Carla gave her a bath, and 30 minutes later, Hannah was tucked snugly into bed by both parents. Alone at last, and wrapped together under a quilt on the rickety sofa, Carla said,
"Okay, what's up?"
Jake, flipping through a sports magazine, replied, "What do you mean, what's up?"
"Don't play dumb. Something's up. A new case, maybe? A new client who can pay a decent fee, or perhaps even a huge fee that might rescue us from poverty. Please?"
Jake flung the quilt onto the floor and jumped to his feet. "Well, as a matter of fact, my dear, there's a good chance we've just stiff-armed poverty."
"I knew it."
"I can always tell when you sign up a good car wreck. You get twitchy." "It's not a car wreck." Jake was thumbing through his briefcase. He pulled out a file and handed her some papers. "It's a suicide."
"Oh, that."
"Yes, that. Last night I told you about the unfortunate demise of Mr. Seth Hubbard. But what I didn't tell you was that before he died, he did a quickie will, mailed it to my office, and designated me as the lawyer for his estate. I probated it late this afternoon. It's now public record, so I can talk about it."
"And this is the guy you never met?"
"Correct."
"A guy you never met,
But you went to his funeral this afternoon.
You got it.
Why did he pick you?
Brilliant reputation. Just read the will, please.
One glance and she said,
But it's handwritten.
No kidding.
Jake reentangled himself with his wife on the sofa and watched her intently as she read the 2-page will. Slowly her mouth dropped open, her eyes widened, and when she finished, she looked at Jake in disbelief and mumbled,
Perish in pain? What a jerk!
Evidently so. Never met the man, but Harry Rex handled his second divorce, and he doesn't think much of Mr. Hubbard.
Most people don't think much of Harry Rex.
This is true.
Who's Letty Lang?
His black housekeeper.
Oh, my gosh, Jake, this is scandalous.
I sure hope so.
Does he have money?
Did you read the part where he says, My estate is substantial?
Ozzie knew him and seems to agree. I'm driving to Temple early in the morning to meet with Mr. Russell Amberg, the executor. I'll be a lot smarter by noon.
She sort of waved the 2 sheets of paper and asked, Is this valid? Can you make a will like this?
Oh, yes. Wills and Estates 101, taught for 50 years by Professor Robert Weems at the Ole Miss Law School.
He gave me an A.
As long as every word is written by the deceased and signed and dated, it's a real will. I'm sure it'll be contested by his 2 kids, but that's where the fun starts.
Why would he leave virtually everything to his black housekeeper?
I guess he liked the way she cleaned his house. I don't know. Maybe she did more than clean.
Meaning?
He was sick, Carla, dying of lung cancer. I suspect Letty Lang cared for him in a lot of ways. Obviously, he was fond of her. His 2 kids will lawyer up and howl about undue influence. They'll claim she got too close to him, whispered in the old guy's ear, and maybe more. It'll be up to the jury.
A jury trial?
Jake was smiling, dreaming. Oh, yes.
Wow. Who knows about this?
I filed a petition at 5 this afternoon, so the gossip hasn't started. But I reckon by 9 in the morning the courthouse will be alive.
This'll blow the top off the courthouse, Jake. A white man with money cuts out his family, leaves it all to his black housekeeper, then hangs himself? Are you kidding?
He was not. She read the will again as her husband closed his eyes and thought about the trial. When she finished, she placed the 2 sheets of paper on the floor, then glanced around the room.
Just curious, dear. But how are your fees determined in a case like this? Forgive me for asking.
She sort of waved a loose arm as she took in the narrow room, the flea market furniture, the cheap bookshelves sagging and overloaded, the fake Persian rug, the secondhand curtains, the stack of magazines piled on the floor, the general shabbiness of renters with better taste, but no way to prove it.
What? You want nicer digs? Maybe a duplex or a double wide?
Don't start with me.
The fees could be substantial. Not that I've considered the subject.
Substantial?
Sure. The fees are based on actual work, billable hours, something we know so little about. The attorney for the estate gets to punch the clock each day and actually get paid for his time. This is unheard of for us. All fees must be approved by the judge, who in this case is our dear friend, the Honorable Reuben Attlee. And since he knows we're starving, he'll probably be in a generous mood. A big estate, a pile of money, a hotly contested will, and we just might avoid bankruptcy.
A pile of money?
Just a figure of speech, dear. We shouldn't get greedy at this point.
Don't patronize me,
she said as she looked into the twinkling eyes of a hungry lawyer.
Right.
But Carla was mentally packing boxes and preparing to move. She had made the same mistake a year earlier when the law offices of Jake Brigance attracted a young couple whose newborn died in a Memphis hospital. A promising case of medical malpractice wilted under the scrutiny of expert review, and Jake had no choice but to settle for nuisance value.
She asked, "And you went to see Letty Lang?"
"I did. She lives out from Box Hill in a community called Little Delta. Not too many white folks around. Her husband is a drunk who comes and goes. I didn't go in the house, but I got the impression it's crowded in there. I checked the land records. They don't own the place. It's a cheap little rental similar
to this dump, right?
Similar to our home. Probably built by the same hack who no doubt went bankrupt. But anyway, there are only three of us here and probably a dozen in Letty's house."
"Is she nice?"
"Nice enough. We didn't talk long. I got the impression she's a fairly typical black woman for these parts, with a house full of kids, a part-time husband, a minimum wage job, a hard life."
"That's pretty harsh."
"Yes, but it's also pretty accurate."
"Is she attractive?"
Under the quilt, Jake began massaging her right calf. He thought for a moment, then said, "I couldn't really tell. It was getting dark in a hurry. She's about 45, seemed to be in fairly good shape, certainly not unattractive."
"Why do you ask?"
"You think sex could be behind Mr. Hubbard's last will and testament?"
"Sex? Who mentioned sex?"
"That's exactly what you're thinking. Did she screw her way into his will?"
"All right, sure, that's what I'm thinking. And that's what the entire town will be buzzing about by noon tomorrow. This has sex written all over it. He was a dying man, and she was his caregiver. Who knows what they did?"
"You have a filthy mind. I love it." His hand moved to her thigh, but there it was blocked. The phone rang, startling both of them. Jake walked to the kitchen, answered it, then hung up. "It's Nesbitt, outside," he said to her. He found a cigar and a box of matches and left the house. At the end of the short driveway by the mailbox, he lit the cigar and blew a cloud of smoke into the cool, crisp evening air. A minute later, a patrol car turned onto the street and rolled to a quiet stop near Jake. Deputy Mike Nesbitt grappled his overweight self out of the car, said,
"Evening, Jake,"
and lit a cigarette. "Evening, Mike." Both blowing smoke, they leaned against the hood of the patrol car. Nesbitt said,
"Nas has found nothing on Hubbard. He ran a search through Jackson and came up dry. Looks like the old boy kept his toys somewhere else. Ain't no records in this state except for his house, cars, acreage, and the lumber yard up near Palmyra. Beyond that, not a trace. I mean nothing. No bank accounts, no corporations, no LLCs, no partnerships. A couple of insurance policies where you'd expect to find them, but that's all. Rumors that he did business in other states, but we ain't got that far yet."
Jake nodded and smoked. By now he was not surprised. "And Amberg?"
"Russell Amberg is from Foley, Alabama, way down south close to Mobile. He was a lawyer there until he got himself disbarred about 15 years ago. Commingling client funds, but no indictment. No criminal record. Freed from the legal profession, he went into the timber business, and it's safe to assume that's where he met Seth Hubbard. As far as we can tell, everything's on the up and up. Not sure why he moved to a dead-end place like Temple. I'm driving to Temple in the morning. I'll ask him."
"Good." An elderly couple walked by with an elderly poodle. They exchanged pleasantries without slowing down. When they were gone, Jake blew more smoke and asked, "Any luck with Ansel Hubbard, the brother?"
"Not a peep. Nothing."
"No surprise. It's funny. I've lived here all my life. Never heard of Seth Hubbard. My dad's 80, lived here all his life, and he's never heard of Seth Hubbard."
"There are 32,000 people in this county, Mike. You can't know all of them."
"Ozzie does.
They had a quick laugh. Nesbitt flipped his cigarette butt into the street and stretched his back.
Guess I need to get home, Jake.
Thanks for stopping by. I'll talk to Ozzie tomorrow.
You do that. See you.
He found Carla in the empty bedroom, sitting in a chair facing the window with a view of the street. The room was dark. He entered quietly, then stopped. And when she knew he was listening, she said,
I'm so sick of seeing police cars in front of my house, Jake.
He took a deep breath and a step closer. This conversation was too familiar, and a wrong word could send it spiraling down.
So am I, he said softly.
What did he want?
She asked. Not much. Just some background on Seth Hubbard. Ozzie's been asking around, but hasn't found much.
He couldn't call you tomorrow? Why does he have to drive over and park in front of our house so everyone can see the Braganzas can't make it through the night without the police showing up again?
Questions with no answers. Jake bit his tongue and eased out of the room. Chapter 8 Russell Amberg hid behind a newspaper in a booth in the rear of the cafe. He was not a regular, nor was he well known in the small town of Temple. He had moved there because of a woman, his third wife, and they stayed to themselves. He also worked for a man who valued discretion and secrecy, and this suited Amberg fine. He secured the booth a few minutes after 7, ordered some coffee, and started reading. On the subject of Seth Hubbard's will or wills, he knew nothing. Though he had worked for Mr. Hubbard for almost a decade, he knew little about his private life. He could put his finger on most of the man's assets, certainly not all, but he had learned early on that his boss loved secrets. And he liked to play games and hold grudges and keep people guessing. The two had traveled extensively together throughout the Southeast as Mr. Hubbard pieced his holdings together. But they had never been close. No one was close to Seth Hubbard. Jake walked in at exactly 7:30 and found Amberg back in a booth. The cafe was half full, and Jake, the foreigner, got some looks as he walked through it. He and Amberg shook hands and exchanged pleasantries. Based on their conversation the day before, Jake was expecting a cool reception and grudging cooperation, though he was not overly concerned with Mr. Amberg's initial reactions. Jake had been directed by Seth Hubbard to do a job, and if he was challenged, the court would stand behind him. Amberg, though, seemed relaxed and sufficiently receptive. After a few minutes of football and weather, he got down to business.
Has the will been probated? He asked.
Yes. As of 5 p.m. yesterday, I left the funeral and hurried back to the courthouse in Clanton.
Did you bring me a copy of it?
I did, Jake said without reaching for a pocket. You were named as executor. It is now a public record, so you can have a copy. Amberg showed both palms and asked,
Am I a beneficiary?
No. He nodded grimly, and Jake could not tell if this was expected.
I get nothing in the will, Amberg asked.
Nothing. Is this a surprise? Amberg swallowed hard and glanced around.
No, he said unconvincingly. Not really. With Seth, there are no surprises.
You're not surprised he killed himself?
Not at all, Mr. Brigance. The last 12 months have been a nightmare. Seth just got tired of the pain. He knew he was dying. We knew he was dying. So, no. No real surprise.
Wait till you read the will. A waitress blew by, barely slowing long enough to top off both cups of coffee. Amberg took a sip and said,
Tell me your story, Mr. Brigance. How did you know Seth?
Never met him, Jake said. He rattled off the short version of why he was now sitting at the table. Amberg listened intently. He had a small, round head that was slick on top, and his nervous habit was to start above the eyebrows with his right hand and sweep back as if the few thick strands of dark hair needed to be continually plastered down. He wore a golf shirt, old khakis, and a light windbreaker, and looked more like a retiree than the businessman from the funeral. Jake was saying, "Is it safe to assume you're his most trusted lieutenant?"
"No, not at all. In fact, I'm not sure why Seth wants me involved in this. I can think of others who were closer."
A long sip of coffee. Then,
"Seth and I didn't always get along. Several times I thought about leaving. The more money he made, the more risks he took. More than once, I became convinced Seth was determined to flame out in some glorious bankruptcy, with the loot hidden offshore, of course. He became fearless, and it was frightening."
"Now that we're on the subject, let's talk about Seth's money."
"Sure, I'll tell you what I know, but I don't know everything."
"Okay," Jake said calmly, as if they were back on the weather. For almost 48 hours, he had been consumed with the burning question of what did Seth possess. Finally, he was about to hear it. He had no legal pad, no pen at the ready, just a cup of black coffee before him. Amberg glanced around again, but no one was listening.
"What I'm about to tell you is not well known. It's not confidential, but Seth did a good job of keeping things hidden."
"It's all about to come out, Mr. Amberg."
"I know."
He took a sip of coffee as if he needed fuel, then leaned in a bit lower.
"Seth had a lot of money, and he made it all in the past 10 years. After his second divorce, he was bitter, angry at the world, broke, and also determined to make some money. He really liked his second wife, and after she ditched him, he wanted revenge. To Seth, revenge meant making more money than what she got in the divorce."
"I know her lawyer very well."
"The big fat guy? What's his name?"
"Harry Rex Viner."
"Harry Rex. I've heard Seth cuss him a few times."
"He's not the only one."
"That's what I hear. Anyway, Seth got his house and land, and he borrowed heavily against them to buy a big lumber mill near Dothan, Alabama. I was working there, buying timber, and that's how I came to know Seth. He got it cheap. Good timing. This was late 1979. The price of plywood spiked, and we were doing pretty well. We had a good hurricane season, lots of damage, lots of demand for plywood and lumber. He borrowed against the mill and bought a furniture factory near Albany, Georgia. The place made these oversized rocking chairs you see on the front porches of griddle restaurants coast to coast. Seth negotiated a contract with the chain, and overnight they couldn't make the rocking chairs fast enough. He pledged the stock, borrowed some more, and bought another furniture factory near Troy, Alabama. About that time, he found a banker in Birmingham who was trying to grow his small bank into something much bigger, and he was aggressive. He and Seth were on the same page, and the deals came one after the other. More factories, more lumber mills, more timber leases. Seth had a nose for sniffing out businesses that were undervalued or in trouble, and his banker rarely said no. I warned him against so much debt, but he was too reckless to listen. He had something to prove. He bought an airplane, kept it in Tupelo so no one around here would know, and stayed in the air."
"Does this have a happy ending?"
"Oh, yes. Over the past 10 years or so, Seth bought about 36 companies, primarily furniture plants in the South, some which he moved to Mexico, but also lumber yards and sawmills, along with thousands of acres of timber, all with borrowed money. I mentioned the one banker in Birmingham, but there were others. The bigger he got, the easier it became to borrow more. As I said, it was at times frightening. But the guy never got burned. He didn't sell a single thing he bought, just held on, looking for the next deal. Deals and debts were like an addiction to Seth. Some men gamble, some drink, some chase women. Seth loved the smell of somebody else's money as he bought another company. He also liked women. Then, sadly, he got sick. It was about a year ago when the doctors told him he had lung cancer. He was ripping along at full speed until he went to the doctor. They told him he had a year max. Needless to say, he was devastated. Without consulting anyone, he decided to sell out. A few years ago, we found the Rush Law Firm in Tupelo, and Seth finally had some guys he could trust. He hated lawyers and fired them as fast as he hired them. But the Rush firm convinced him to consolidate everything into one holding company. Last November, he sold the holding company to a leveraged buyout group in Atlanta for $55 million. He happily repaid his debts to the tune of about $35 million.
He netted 20?
He netted 20, give or take. There were a few other loose ends, including me. I had some stock in the holding company, and so I walked away in good shape. I retired at the end of last year. I don't know what Seth has done with the money since then. Probably buried it in the backyard. Plus, he accumulated other assets that he kept out of the holding company. There's a cabin in the mountains of North Carolina, and quite a few other assets. There's probably an offshore bank account or two. Probably? I can't say for certain, Mr. Brigance. Just things I've heard over the years. As I said, Seth Hubbard loved his secrets.
Well, Mr. Amberg, you as his executor and I as his lawyer have the job of tracking down all assets.
Shouldn't be too hard. We'll need access to his office.
And where is that?
At the lumber yard near Palmyra. That was his only office. There's a secretary there, Arlene, who runs the show. I spoke to her Sunday night and suggested that she keep everything locked up until she hears from the lawyers.
Jake took another sip of coffee and tried to digest it all. $20 million, huh? I can't think of anyone else in Ford County with that kind of money.
I can't help you there, Mr. Brigance. I've never lived there. I assure you, though, there's no one here in Milburn County worth even a fraction of that.
It's the rural South.
Indeed it is. That's the greatness of Seth's story. He woke up one day at the age of 60 and said, I'm broke, tired of being broke, and damned if I'm not going to make something. He got lucky on his first two deals, then discovered the beauty of using other people's money. He mortgaged his own house and land a dozen times. Talk about brass balls.
The waitress delivered oatmeal for Mr. Amberg and scrambled eggs for Jake. As they sprinkled salt and sugar, Amberg asked,
Did he cut out his kids?
He did. A smile, a nod, no surprise.
You expected this? Jake asked.
I expect nothing, Mr. Brigance, and nothing surprises me,
he replied smugly.
I have a surprise for you, Jake said. He cut out both of his kids, both of his ex-wives, who, by the way, are not entitled to anything, and he cut out everybody else, except for his long-lost brother Ansel, who's probably dead, but if not, gets 5%. His church also on board at 5%, which leaves a grand total of 90% left to his black housekeeper of 3 years, one Letty Lang. Amberg stopped chewing as his jaws sagged and his eyes squinted. Deep wrinkles broke out across his forehead. Don't tell me you're not surprised, Jake said, victorious, then tossed back a forkful of eggs. Amberg took a deep breath and reached out an empty hand. Jake pulled a copy of the will out of a pocket and gave it to him. The deep wrinkles hardened as both pages were read. He began to shake his head in disbelief. He read it a second time, then folded it and placed it aside.
Did you by chance know Letty Lang? Jake asked.
Never met her. I've never seen Seth's home, Mr. Brigance. Never heard him say a word about it, really. Or about anyone who worked there. Seth kept things in compartments, most of which were off-limits to everyone. Do you know this woman?
I met her yesterday for the first time. She'll be in my office this afternoon. With his fingertips, Amberg slowly pushed the platter and bowl away. Breakfast was over, the appetite gone.
Why would he do this, Mr. Brigance?
I was thinking of asking you the same question.
Well, it obviously makes no sense, and that's why this will is in serious trouble. He was out of his mind. You can't make a valid will if you lack testamentary capacity.
Of course not. But little is clear right now. On the one hand, he seems to have planned his death in meticulous detail, as if he knew exactly what he was doing. On the other hand, leaving it all to his housekeeper is hard to figure.
Unless she influenced him.
I'm sure that'll be argued. Amberg reached for a pocket and said,
Mind if I smoke?
No. He lit a menthol and flicked ashes into his oatmeal. His mind was spinning. Nothing made sense. Finally, he said,
I'm not sure I have the stomach for this, Mr. Brigance. I may be named as the executor, but that doesn't mean I have to serve.
You said you were a lawyer once. You sound like it.
In the day, I was a small-town hack, same as a million others, over in Alabama. But probate laws don't vary much from state to state.
You're right. You don't have to serve as executor.
Who would want to get involved in this mess?
Me, for one, thought Jake, but he bit his tongue. The waitress cleared the table and topped off the coffee cups. Amberg read the will again and lit another cigarette. When he'd emptied his lungs, he said,
Okay, Mr. Brigance, allow me to think out loud. Seth mentions a prior will, one prepared last year by the Rush Law Firm in Tupelo. I know those guys, and it's safe to assume that will is much thicker, much smarter, and put together in such a way as to take advantage of proper estate tax planning, gift exclusions, generation skipping transfers, the whole nine yards, okay? Whatever is available to protect the estate and legally avoid as much in taxes as possible. Are you with me?
Yes.
Then, at the last minute, Seth prepares this crude document that revokes the proper will, leaves virtually everything to his black housekeeper, and guarantees that much of what he's trying to give away will be eaten up in estate taxes. Still with me?
About 50% will go for taxes, Jake said.
Half. Blown away, just like that. Does that sound like a man who's thinking clearly, Mr. Brigance?
It did not, though Jake was not ready to yield an inch. He said, I'm sure that argument will be made in court, Mr. Amberg. My job is to probate the estate and pursue the wishes of my client.
Spoken like a true lawyer.
Thank you. Are you going to serve as the executor?
Will I get paid?
Yes, there will be a fee to be approved by the judge.
How much time will be involved?
Could be a lot. If there is a will contest, which seems likely, we could be in court for hours, for days. As executor, you'll have to be there, listening to every witness.
But, Mr. Brigance, I don't like this will. I don't approve of what Seth did. I have not seen the other will, the thick one, but I'm pretty damn certain I like it better. Why should I be an advocate for this slipshod, last-minute, handwritten piece of crap that gives everything to an undeserving black housekeeper who probably had too much influence over the old boy? Know what I mean?
Jake nodded slightly and frowned with great suspicion. After 30 minutes with this guy, he was fairly certain he didn't want to spend the next year with him. Replacing an executor was generally no big deal, and Jake knew he could convince the judge that this guy needed to go. Amber glanced around again and said softly,
"It makes no sense. Seth worked like a dog the last 10 years of his life to build a fortune. He took enormous risks. He got lucky. And then he dumps it all in the lap of some woman who didn't have a damn thing to do with his success. Kind of makes me sick, Mr. Brigance. Sick and very suspicious."
"Then don't serve as executor, Mr. Amberg. I'm sure the court can find someone else to do the job." Jake picked up the will, creased the folds, and stuck it back into his pocket. "But sleep on it. There's no rush."
"When does the war start?"
"Soon. The other lawyers will show up with the other will."
"Should be fascinating."
"Thanks for your time, Mr. Amberg. Here's my card." Jake left his business card and a $5 bill on the table and hurried out. He sat in his car for a moment, thinking, trying to collect his thoughts and get his mind focused on a contested estate worth $20 million. A year earlier, Clanton had gossiped its way through a lawsuit over an insurance policy covering a fertilizer plant that had mysteriously burned to the ground. Its owner was a local shyster named Bobby Carl Leach, a shifty operator with a history of burned buildings and lawsuits. Fortunately, Jake was not involved in the litigation. He avoided Leach at all costs. But during the trial, it was revealed that Leach had a net worth of about $4 million. There was nothing liquid about his balance sheet, but when his liabilities were subtracted from his assets, there was an impressive figure for his equity. This has led to countless discussions and arguments over who exactly was the richest person in Ford County. The debates had raged over early morning coffee around the square and in bars where bankers met after hours and throughout the courthouse where lawyers huddled to exaggerate the latest testimony. All over town, literally. Bobby Carl, with $4 million, was certainly at the top of the list. The Wilbanks clan would have been had Lucian not squandered the family fortune decades earlier. Several farmers were mentioned, but only out of habit. They had family money, which by the late 1980s meant they owned sections of land, but struggled to pay their bills. A man named Willie Traynor had sold the Ford County Times 8 years earlier for $1.5 million, and there were rumors he'd doubled his money in the stock market. However, few rumors about Willie had ever been taken seriously. A 98-year-old woman held bank stock worth $6 million. As the contest wore on, an anonymous list appeared in a court clerk's office and was soon faxed all over town. It was cleverly labeled Forbes Top 10 List of Richest Ford Countyans. Everybody had a copy, and this fueled the gossip. The list was edited, enlarged, detailed, amended, and modified, and even fictionalized. But through it all, there was no mention of Mr. Seth Hubbard. The town's exercise in speculation went on with enthusiasm for several weeks before running out of gas. Not surprisingly, Jake had never seen his own name on the list. He chuckled to himself as he thought of Ms. Letty Lang and her forthcoming and rather dramatic entry onto the list. Chapter 9. For her last day on the job, Letty arrived half an hour early, and she did so in the hopeless belief that such punctuality might impress Mr. Herschel and Mrs. Defoe, that they might somehow reconsider and allow her to stay on. At 7:30, she parked her 12-year-old Pontiac next to Mr. Seth's pickup truck. She had stopped calling him Mr. Seth months earlier. When they were alone, anyway. Around other people, she used the mister, but only for appearances. She took a deep breath and clutched the wheel and hated the thought of seeing those people again. They would be leaving soon as possible. She'd heard them gripe about being forced to spend two nights there. Their worlds back home were crumbling, and they were desperate to get away. Burying their father was such a nuisance. They despised Ford County. She had slept little. Mr. Brigance's words, "sizable portion of his estate," had rattled noisily around her brain throughout the night. She had not told Simeon. Perhaps she would later. Perhaps she would let Mr. Brigance do it. Simeon had badgered her about what the lawyer wanted, what he had said. But Letty had been too bewildered and too frightened to try and explain anything. And how could she explain what she didn't understand? As confused as she was, Letty knew the most foolish thing she could do was to believe in a positive outcome. The day she saw any money would be the day she believed, and not a moment before. The kitchen door off the garage was unlocked. Letty entered quietly and paused to listen for sounds of activity. The television was on in the den. Coffee was brewing on the counter. She coughed as loudly as possible, and a voice called,
"Is that you, Letty?"
"It is," she said sweetly. She stepped into the den, behind a fake smile, and found Ian Defoe on the sofa, still in his pajamas, surrounded by paperwork, lost in the details of some looming deal.
"Good morning, Mr. Defoe," she said.
"Good morning, Letty," he replied with a smile. "How are you?"
"Fine, thanks. And you?"
"As well as can be expected. Up most of the night with this," he said, sweeping an arm over his beloved paperwork, as if she knew exactly what it all meant. "Get me some coffee, would you? Black."
"Yes, sir."
Letty took him coffee, which he accepted without a nod or a word, lost once more in his deal. She returned to the kitchen, poured herself some coffee, and when she opened the refrigerator to get the cream, she saw a bottle of vodka, almost empty. She had never seen liquor in the house. Seth didn't keep it. Once a month he brought home a few beers, stuck them in the fridge, and then usually forgot about them. The sink was full of dirty dishes. How could they possibly be expected to load the dishwasher with a servant on the payroll? Letty got busy with the cleaning, and presently Mr. Defoe stopped at the door and said,
"I think I'll get a shower now. Ramona is not feeling well, probably caught a cold."
Cold or vodka, Letty thought. But she said,
"I'm sorry. Can I do anything for her?"
"Not really. But some breakfast would be nice. Eggs and bacon. Scramble for me. Not sure about Herschel."
"I'll ask him."
Since they were leaving, as was the servant, and since the house was about to be locked up, then sold or somehow disposed of, Letty decided to clean out the pantry and refrigerator. She fried bacon and sausage, whipped up pancakes, scrambled eggs, and made omelets and cheese grits, and warmed up store-bought biscuits, Seth's favorite brand. The table was covered with steaming bowls and platters when the three sat down for breakfast, complaining the entire time about all the food and fuss. But they ate. Ramona, puffy-eyed and red-faced, and unwilling to say much, seemed to especially crave the grease. Letty hung around for a few minutes, properly serving them, and the mood was tense. She suspected they'd had a rough night, drinking and arguing, and trying to survive one last night in a house they hated. She eased back into the bedrooms, happy to see their bags were packed. From the shadows, she heard Herschel and Ian discussing a visit by the lawyers. Ian argued it was easier for the lawyers to come to Seth's house than for the three of them to troop over to Tupelo.
"Damn right they can come to us," Ian said. "They'll be here at 10.
Okay,
Herschel conceded. Then they lowered their voices. After breakfast, as Letty cleared the table and stacked the dishes, the three moved outdoors again, to the patio where they settled around the picnic table and drank their coffee in the morning sun. Ramona seemed to perk up. Letty, who lived with a drunk, figured that most mornings started slow for Mrs. Defoe. There was laughter as they momentarily shook off last night's harsh words, whatever they were. The doorbell rang. It was a locksmith from Clanton. Herschel showed him around and explained loudly for the benefit of Letty that they wanted new locks on the home's four exterior doors. As the man went to work, starting with the front door, Herschel stopped in the kitchen and said,
"We're getting all new locks, Letty, so the old keys won't work."
"I've never had a key,"
she said with an edge because she had already said it once.
"Right," Herschel replied, not believing. "We'll leave one key with Calvin down the road, and we'll keep the others. I suspect I'll be back from time to time to check on things."
"Whatever," Letty thought, but she said,
"I'll be happy to come over and clean the place whenever you want. Calvin can let me in."
"Won't be necessary, but thanks. We're meeting with the lawyers at 10 o'clock here, so make some fresh coffee. After that, we'll be leaving for home. I'm afraid we won't be needing you after that, Letty. Sorry, but Dad's death changes everything."
She clenched her jaws and said,
"I understand."
"How often did he pay you?"
"Every Friday, for 40 hours.
"And he paid you last Friday?"
"That's right."
"So we owe you for Monday, Tuesday, and half of today, right?"
"I suppose."
"At $5 an hour?"
"Yes, sir."
"I still can't believe he paid you that much,"
Herschel said as he opened the door and walked outside onto the patio. Letty was stripping the beds when the lawyers arrived. In spite of the dark suits and serious faces, they might as well have been Santa Claus delivering sacks of toys to well-behaved children. In the moments before they pulled into the driveway, Ramona, in heels and pearls and a dress much prettier than the one she had worn to the funeral, peeked out the front window a dozen times. Ian, now in a coat and tie, paced around the den, checking his watch. Herschel, clean-shaven for the first time since arriving, was in and out of the kitchen door. In the past 3 days, Letty had overheard enough to know that expectations were high. They did not know how much money old Seth had in the bank, but they were perceptive enough to believe something was there. And it was all a windfall anyway, right? The house and land alone were worth at least $500,000. According to Ian's latest guess. How often are you lucky enough to split $500,000? And there was the lumberyard, and who knew what else? They gathered in the den, three lawyers, three potential beneficiaries, all well-dressed with perfect manners and light moods. The servant, in her best white cotton dress, served them coffee and cake, and then retired into the shadows to listen. Grave condolences were offered by the lawyers. They had known Seth for several years and were great admirers. What a man! It was entirely possible the lawyers thought more of Seth than did his own children. But at that moment, this was not contemplated. Herschel and Ramona performed well, even admirably, as the conversation passed through its first phase. Ian seemed bored with the preliminaries and ready to get down to business.
"I have an idea," Herschel said. "There could be other ears listening right now. It's a lovely day, so let's move outside to the patio where things are, shall I say, more confidential."
"Really, Herschel?" Ramona protested, but Ian was already standing. The group moved en masse through the kitchen and onto the patio, where they resituated around the picnic table. An hour earlier, Letty, in anticipation, had cracked a bathroom window. She now sat on the edge of the bathtub and could hear better than ever. Mr. Lewis McGuire popped open his heavy briefcase and removed a file. He passed around three copies of a multi-page document and began,
Our firm prepared this for your father over a year ago. There's a lot of boilerplate in there. Sorry, but that's always required.
Ramona, nervous and still red-eyed, said,
I'll read it later. Please, just tell us what's in the will.
Very well, Mr. McGuire said. To skin it all down, each of you, Herschel and Ramona, gets 40% of the estate. Some of it's outright, some of it's tied up in trusts, but the bottom line is that you will inherit 80% of Mr. Hubbard's estate.
And the other 20? Ian demanded.
15% goes into trust for the grandchildren, and 5% is an outright gift to the Irish Road Christian Church.
What's in the estate? Herschel asked.
Stillman Rush calmly replied,
The assets are substantial.
When Letty emerged half an hour later with a pot of fresh coffee, the mood had changed in startling ways. Gone was the nervousness, the anticipation, the initial round of gloom and loss, all replaced by a giddiness that only instant and unearned wealth can create. They had just won the lottery. Now their only concern was how to collect it. With so much money floating around, the six clammed up immediately when Letty appeared. Not a word was spoken as she poured the coffee. When the kitchen door closed behind her, all six began chattering away again. Letty was listening and growing more confused by the minute. The will on the table named Lewis McGuire as the executor of the estate. So not only did he prepare the will, but he also bore the principal responsibility for its probate and administration. The third lawyer, Mr. Sam Larkin, had been the principal business advisor to Seth and seemed quick to take credit for his incredible success. Larkin waxed on about one deal after another, regaling his audience with Seth's fearless exploits when borrowing reckless amounts of money, or so it seemed. Turns out Seth was smarter than them all. Only Ian tired of this narrative. Mr. McGuire explained that since they were already in Ford County, they planned to run by the courthouse and file the necessary paperwork to initiate the probate proceedings. A notice to creditors would run in the county newspaper for 90 days and invite claims from anyone Seth might owe. Frankly, Mr. McGuire said, he doubted if there were unknown creditors out there. Seth was aware of his impending death. The two had spoken less than a month earlier.
Stillman Rush said, All in all, we see this as a fairly routine probate, but it will take time.
More fees, thought Ian.
In a few months, we'll submit to the court an accounting and inventory of all your father's assets and liabilities. To do so, we'll be required to hire a CPA firm, and we know several, to track down the assets. All real estate must be appraised, all personal property listed. It's a process.
How long? Ramona asked.
The three lawyers squirmed in unison, the usual reaction when an effort is made to solicit exact information. Lewis McGuire, the most senior, shrugged and offered a noncommittal,
I'd say 12 to 18 months.
Ian grimaced as he absorbed this and thought of all the loans coming due in the next 6 months. Herschel frowned while trying not to, while trying to act as though his bank accounts were stuffed and there was no pressure. Ramona shook her head angrily and asked,
Why so long?
Mr. McGuire replied,
Fair question.
Oh, thank you.
12 months is not really a long time in these matters. A lot of groundwork has to be laid. Fortunately, your father had significant assets. Few estates do. If he'd died with nothing, then his probate could be complete in 90 days.
In Florida, the average probate takes 30 months, Mr. Larkin said.
This ain't Florida, Ian said with a cold stare.
Stillman Rush added quickly,
and there is a provision in the law for partial distributions, that is, you might be allowed to take some of your share along the way before the actual closing of the estate.
I like the sound of that, Ramona said.
Can we talk about taxes? Ian insisted. What's the ballpark figure?
Mr. McGuire leaned back and confidently crossed his legs. Smiling and nodding, he said,
With an estate of this size, with no surviving spouse, the taxes would be brutal, slightly more than 50%. But because of Mr. Hubbard's foresight and our expertise, we were able to arrive at a plan.
He lifted a copy of the will.
And by the use of some trusts and other devices, we have reduced the effective tax rate to about 30%.
Ian, the number cruncher, did not need a calculator. 20 million and change in the net estate minus 30% would knock it down to about 14 mil. 40% of that for his dear wife, and their share would be around $5.6 million, give or take. And clean, no taxes, since all of those nasties, state and federal, would be slapped onto the estate. At that moment, Ian and his various partners and companies owed a plethora of banks in excess of $4 million, about half of which was past due. As Herschel's internal calculator stuttered along, he caught himself humming under his breath. Seconds later, he too arrived at something around $5.5 million. He was so sick of living with his mother, and his kids, no more worries about tuition. Ramona turned evil and cast a vicious smile at her husband. She said,
$20 million, Ian. Not too bad for, what did you like to call him, an uneducated logger?
Herschel closed his eyes and exhaled, while Ian said,
Come on, Ramona.
The lawyers were suddenly interested in their shoes. She pressed on,
You won't make $20 million in your entire life, and Daddy did it in 10 years. And your family, with all the banks they once owned, never had that kind of money. Don't you find that unbelievable, Ian?
Ian's mouth fell open, and he could only stare at her. Alone, he would have certainly gone for her throat, but he was helpless. Be cool, he told himself, as he fought his anger. Damn right you'd better be cool, because that smirking bitch sitting 5 feet away is about to inherit several million, and though the money will probably blow up the marriage, there will be something for me. Stillman Rush closed his briefcase and said,
Well, we need to be moving along. We'll run by the courthouse and kick things off, and we'll need to meet again very shortly, if that's okay.
He was standing as he spoke, suddenly eager to leave the family behind. McGuire and Larkin bounced up too, slapping closed their briefcases and making the same phony farewells. They insisted on showing themselves to the front and were practically scrambling when they disappeared around the house. After they left, there was a long, lethal vacuum of silence on the patio as all three avoided eye contact and wondered who would speak next. The wrong word could start another fight or something worse. Finally, Ian, the angriest, asked his wife,
Why'd you say that in front of the lawyers?
Herschel jumped in.
No, why did you say it, period?
She ignored her brother and snarled at her husband.
Because I've been wanting to say it for a long time, Ian. You've always looked down on us, especially my father. And now, suddenly, you're counting his money.
Aren't we all?
Herschel asked.
Shut up, Herschel, she snapped.
She ignored him and didn't take her eyes off Ian.
I'll divorce you now. You know that.
Didn't take long.
No, it didn't.
Come on, guys,
Herschel pleaded. This was not the first divorce threat he had witnessed.
Let's go inside, finish packing, and get out of here.
The men stood slowly and walked away. Ramona stared at the trees in the distance,
beyond the backyard, and into a forest where she played as a child. She had not felt such freedom in years. Another cake arrived before noon, and Letty tried to decline it. She eventually sat it on the kitchen counter, where she was wiping pots for the last time. The Defoes said a quick goodbye, but only because they really couldn't leave without doing so. Ramona promised to keep in touch, and so on. Letty watched them get in the car without saying a word. It would be a long drive back to Jackson. At noon, Calvin arrived as planned, and at the kitchen table, Herschel handed over a key to the new door locks. Calvin was to check on the house every other day, keep the grass cut, leaves blown, the usual. When Calvin was gone, Herschel said,
"So, Letty, I figure we owe you for 18 hours at $5 each, right?"
"Whatever you say."
He was writing a check as he stood at the counter.
$90, he mumbled with a frown, still wanting to gripe over her excessive pay.
He signed it, tore it out, handed it over, and said,
"There you are,"
as if it were a gift.
"Thank you."
"Thanks, Letty, for taking care of Dad and the house and everything. I know this is not easy."
Firmly, she said,
"I understand."
"The way things go, I'm sure we'll never see you again. But I just want you to know how much we appreciate what you did for our dad."
Such a load of crap, Letty thought. But she said,
"Thank you."
Her eyes were watering as she folded the check. After an awkward pause, he said,
"Well, Letty, I'd like for you to leave now so I can lock up."
"Yes, sir."
Chapter 10. Three well-dressed lawyers from out of town, strutting through the courthouse on a dull Wednesday morning, were bound to attract attention, which didn't seem to bother them at all. One lawyer could have easily performed the menial task, but three could charge triple for it. They ignored the local lawyers and the clerks and the courthouse regulars in the hallways and purposefully entered the office of the chancery clerk. There they were met by Sarah, who had been alerted by Jake Brigance, who had been alerted by a surprise call from Letty Lang, then still at Seth's house, with the news that an entire pack of lawyers had just left and was headed for Clanton. Stillman Rush flashed a killer smile at Sarah, who was slowly chewing gum and glaring at the men as if they were trespassers.
"We're from the Rush Law Firm in Tupelo," he announced,
and not one of the other three clerks looked up. The soft music from a radio failed to stop.
"Congratulations," Sarah said. "Welcome to Clanton."
Louis McGuire had opened his fine briefcase and was removing papers. Stillman said,
"Yes. Well, we need to file a petition to probate an estate."
With a flurry, the paperwork landed on the counter in front of Sarah, who, chewing, looked at it without touching it.
"Who died?"
she asked.
"A man named Seth Hubbard," Stillman said, an octave higher,
but still not loud enough to draw the attention of anyone in the office of the Ford County Chancery Clerk.
"Never heard of him," Sarah deadpanned. "He lived in this county?"
"He did, up near Palmyra." She finally touched the papers, picked them up, and immediately began frowning.
"When did he die?"
she asked. "Last Sunday."
"They buried him yet?"
Stillman almost blurted, "Is that really any of your business?" But he caught himself. He was on foreign soil, and alienating the underlings could only cause trouble. He swallowed, managed to smile, and said,
"Yesterday."
Sarah's eyes rolled up the wall as if she were bothered by something.
Seth Hubbard.
Over her shoulder, she said,
"Hey, Eva, didn't we get something already on Seth Hubbard?"
From 30 feet away, Eva replied,
"Late yesterday. A new file in the rack over there."
Sarah took a few steps, yanked out a file, and scanned it as the three lawyers froze and watched every move. Finally, she said,
"Yep, got a petition to probate the last will and testament of Mr. Henry Seth Hubbard. Filed at 4:55 yesterday afternoon."
Each of the three lawyers attempted to say something at once, but none could do so. Finally, Stillman managed a weak,
"What the hell? I didn't file it,"
Sarah said.
"I'm just a lowly clerk."
"Is that a public record?"
Mr. McGuire asked.
"It is."
She slid the file onto the counter, and all three heads grouped over it, ear to ear to ear. Sarah turned around, winked at the other girls, and returned to her desk. 5 minutes later, Roxy buzzed Jake on his phone intercom.
"Mr. Brigance, there are some gentlemen here to see you."
From the terrace, Jake had watched them storm out of the courthouse and march in his direction.
"Do they have an appointment?"
"No, sir, and they say it's urgent."
"I'm in a meeting which will take another 30 minutes, Jake said in his empty office. "They're welcome to wait."
Roxy, who had been quickly briefed, put the phone down and delivered the message. The lawyers frowned and exhaled and fidgeted and finally decided to step out for some coffee. At the door, Stillman said,
"Please explain to Mr. Brigance that this is an urgent matter."
"That's already been done."
"Yes. Well, thanks."
Jake heard the door close solidly and smiled to himself. They would be back, and he looked forward to the meeting. He returned his attention to the latest weekly edition of the Ford County Times, published early each Wednesday morning, and a rich source of local news. On the front page, below the fold, there was a brief story about the death of Mr. Seth Hubbard, an apparent suicide. The reporter had followed leads and done some digging. Unnamed sources whispered that Mr. Hubbard had once had extensive holdings in lumber, furniture, and timber rights throughout the Southeast. He had unloaded most of his assets less than a year ago. No one from his family had returned calls. There was a portrait photo of Seth as a much younger man. He looked nothing like the poor guy hanging from a rope in Ozzie's grisly death scene photos. But then who would? 20 minutes later, the lawyers were back. Roxy parked them in the conference room on the first floor. They stood by the window and watched the languid pre-lunch traffic around the square and waited. Occasionally they would whisper to one another, as if the room had bugs and someone else might be listening. Finally, Mr. Brigance entered and welcomed them. There were forced smiles and stiff but courteous handshakes, and when they were finally seated, Roxy asked about coffee or water. Everyone declined, and she closed the door and disappeared. Jake and Stillman had finished law school at Ole Miss 10 years earlier, and though they had known each other during that ordeal and often had classes together, they ran in different circles. As the favored son in a family who owned a law firm claiming to be 100 years old, Stillman's future was secure before he briefed his first case in contracts. Jake and virtually all the others were forced to scramble for employment. To his credit, Stillman worked hard to prove himself and graduated in the top 10%. Jake was not far behind. As lawyers, their paths had crossed once since law school, when Lucian ordered Jake to file an unpromising sex discrimination case against an employer, one represented by the Rush Law Firm. The outcome was a draw, but during the process, Jake came to despise Stillman. He had been tolerable in law school, but a few years in the trenches had made him a big shot in a big firm with the requisite ego. He wore his blonde hair a bit longer now, and it flipped up around his ears, contrasting nicely with the fine black wool suit he was wearing. Jake had never met Mr. McGuire or Mr. Larkin, but he knew them by reputation. It was a small state. "To what do I owe this honor, gentlemen?" Jake began.
"Oh, I think you've figured it out by now, Jake," Stillman replied smugly. "I saw you at Mr. Hubbard's funeral yesterday. We've read his holographic will, and it's rather self-explanatory."
"It's deficient in many ways," Lewis McGuire inserted gravely.
"I didn't prepare it," Jake shot across the table.
"But you're offering it for probate," Stillman said. "Obviously, you must think it's valid."
"I have no reason to think otherwise. The will came to me in the mail. I was directed to probate it. Here we are."
"But how can you advocate for something as shoddy as this?" Sam Larkin asked, gently lifting a copy of the will.
Jake glared at him with all the contempt he could generate. Typical big firm asshole. Far superior to the rest of us because you bill by the hour and get paid for it. In your well-educated and learned opinion, this will is shoddy and thus invalid. Therefore, everyone else's opinion should fall in line. Jake kept his cool and said, "It's a waste of time for us to sit here and debate the merits of Mr. Hubbard's handwritten will. Let's save that for the courtroom." And with that, Jake delivered the first salvo. The courtroom was, after all, where he'd made his reputation, whatever it happened to be. Mr. McGuire prepared wills, and Mr. Larkin prepared contracts, and as far as Jake could tell, Stillman's specialty was defending commercial arson cases, though he fancied himself an aggressive courtroom lawyer. The courtroom, Jake's courtroom, the one across the street in his courthouse, was where the great Haley trial had raged barely 3 years earlier. And though the other three would not admit it, they too had watched that trial keenly from a distance. Like every lawyer in the state, they had been green with envy at Jake's exposure.
"Is it fair to ask about your relationship with Seth Hubbard?" Stillman asked politely.
"Never met the man. He died Sunday, and his will arrived in my mailbox on Monday."
They were fascinated by this and took a moment to absorb it. Jake decided to press on.
"I'll admit I've never had a case like this, never probated a handwritten will. I assume you have plenty of copies of the old one, the one your firm prepared last year. Don't suppose I could have a copy, could I?"
They shifted and glanced at each other.
Stillman said, "Well, Jake, if that will had been admitted to probate, then it would be public, and we'd give you a copy. However, we withdrew it once we learned another will was already in play, so I guess our will is still a confidential document."
"Fair enough." The three continued to exchange nervous looks, and it was apparent none of them knew exactly what to do next. Jake said nothing, but enjoyed watching their discomfort. Stillman, the litigator, said,
So, Jake, we ask you to withdraw the handwritten will and allow us to proceed with the authentic one."
"The answer is no."
"No surprise. How do you suggest we proceed?"
"It's very simple, Stillman. Let's file a joint request with the court to have a hearing to address the situation. Judge Attlee will look at both wills, and believe me, he'll devise a game plan. I practice in his court every month, and there's no doubt who'll be in charge."
"I was thinking the same thing," Lewis McGuire said. "I've known Reuben for many years, and I think we should start with him."
"I'll be happy to arrange things," Jake said.
"So you haven't spoken to him yet?"
Stillman asked. "Of course not. He knows nothing about this. The funeral was yesterday, remember?"
They managed to exchange cordial goodbyes and separate peacefully, though all four knew they were in for a brawl. Lucian was sitting on his front porch, drinking what appeared to be lemonade, which he occasionally did when his body and his life became so overwhelmed with sour mash that he managed to break free for a week or so and suffer the horrors of detox. The porch wrapped around an old house on a hill just outside Clanton, with a view of the town below and the courthouse cupola square in the middle. The house, like most of Lucian's assets and burdens, was a hand-me-down from ancestors he deemed wretched, but who, with hindsight, had done an admirable job of securing for him a comfortable life. Lucian was 63, but an old man, his face grizzled and whiskered gray to match his long, unkempt hair. The whiskey and cigarettes were adding patches of wrinkles to his face. Too much time on the porch was adding a thickness to his waist and a gloominess to his always complicated moods. He had lost his license to practice 9 years earlier, and according to the terms of his disbarment, he could now apply for reinstatement. He had dropped that bomb on Jake a couple of times to gauge his response, but got nothing. Nothing visible anyway, but just under the surface, Jake was mortified at the thought of reacquiring a senior partner who owned the building and was impossible to work with or under. If Lucian became a lawyer again and moved back in his office, Jake's current one, and started suing everyone who crossed him and defending pedophiles and rapists and capital murderers, Jake wouldn't last 6 months. "How are you, Lucian?" Jake said as he climbed the steps. Sober, clear-eyed, and feeling fresh, Lucian replied,
"I'm fine, Jake. Always a pleasure to see you."
"You offered lunch. Have I ever said no to lunch?" Weather permitting, they ate at least twice a month on the porch.
"Not that I recall," Lucian said, standing in his bare feet and offering a hand.
They shook heartily, did the quick shoulder-pat thing that men do when they really don't want to hug one another, and took their seats in aging white wicker chairs that had not been moved more than 6 inches since Jake's first visit a decade earlier. Sally eventually appeared and said hi to Jake. He said iced tea would be fine, and she strolled away, never in a hurry. She had been hired as a housekeeper, then promoted to a nurse to care for Lucian when he threw a bender and checked out for 2 weeks. At some point, she moved in, and for a while the gossip rippled through Clanton. It died soon enough, though, because nothing Lucian Wilbanks could do would really shock anyone.